Major funding for the connection is provided by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be. Available on the web at www.macromedia.com.
I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. It's been 30 years since the last draft card was printed. 30 years since young Americans waited and wondered when or whether their names might appear in the lottery. 30 years is a generation in military terms. This week, as both houses of Congress reconvene, there's talk about reintroducing the draft. A congressman from New York has drawn up a bill to that effect, but it is just talk. Everyone agrees that the draft is not about to make a comeback. Representative Charles Rangel is trying to get people thinking about the whole notion of shared sacrifice and whether politicians whose children are not serving choose war more easily than they would if their sons or daughters were on an aircraft carrier in the Gulf. So, Connection listeners, here's the question. Is it time to bring back the draft? Would that sense of shared sacrifice change the way politicians make decisions about war? Would it change the way you feel about it? Our number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And a special welcome today to new Connection listeners, people joining us in Baton Rouge on WRKF, and to listeners in St. Louis on KWMU. Peter Fever is with us. He is director of the Triangle Institute for Security Studies at Duke University and co-editor of Soldiers and Civilians, The Civil-Military Gap and American National Security. Welcome to The Connection.
Thanks for having me.
And David Siegel is also here. He's director of the Center for Research on Military Organization at the University of Maryland. He's joining us from our NPR studio in Washington, D.C. Thank you for joining us, David.
It's my pleasure.
Let me start with you, if I can. What do you think about this proposal of Mr. Rangel's to bring back the draft?
I agree with the assessment that it is not likely to happen. I very much appreciate his notion that people on the Hill need to remember where the American people are and whose sons or daughters are going to be fighting a war if we go to war. I think it's very unlikely that it will be the sons of daughters and daughters of people on the Hill who get drafted if we, in fact, go back to the kind of conscription system we've had in the past.
Peter, do the politicians lose touch with those sorts of decisions when their own sons and daughters aren't serving?
Well, there are some correct premises in Congressman Rangel and Conyers' proposal, but there are also some dangerously wrong premises as well. It's an odd mix. On the correct side, it's true that the presence of veterans in the political elite does matter, not necessarily for congressional votes, but for the overall propensity of the United States to initiate the use of force. Our study showed that the more veterans there are in Congress, the less likely the U.S. is to initiate the use of force. And this is a
The less likely
okay. The U.S. is to use force. But the more likely it will be a major use of force, a major war. Now, and it's also true that having friends and loved ones in the military does make someone more sensitive to combat casualties. We asked several casualties questions, and people who had reported that they had a friend or a child serving in the military gave lower casualty estimates than people who did not. So those two premises are correct in Rangel's argument. The wrong premise is that Rangel claims that U.S. policymakers, now the political leaders, have been cavalier about U.S. casualties. And this is exactly wrong. In fact, on the contrary, over the past decade, U.S. policymakers have been overly casualty phobic to an extent that they have demanded U.S. deployments with zero casualties like we had in Kosovo. And that has directly contributed to needless deaths around the world and indeed to the rise of al-Qaeda and other forms of challenges to the U.S.
So let me just flip that around. Does that mean that if the sons and daughters of congressional representatives are serving, that in fact there's a bolder attitude, a willingness to accept the sacrifice of men and women dying overseas?
No. He's right that if they had sons and daughters, they might be even less likely. But the point is that political leaders have been at a zero casualty tolerance already.
I've got you.
And so they're already afflicted with the cure that he wants them to have. They have the cure so bad they need to be cured from it.
David, Congressman Rangel makes the point that there are a handful of representatives with sons and daughters either as enlisted or officers. But it's also true that, and Peter made reference to this, that there are fewer veterans in those halls of power today than there have been in some considerable time, right?
That is true. Basically, the veteran population of the Congress, like the veteran population of the United States, was the World War II generation, when a very large proportion of the male workforce served. As we have gone into a larger society with a smaller number of people serving, we've had fewer veterans both in the Congress and in society as a whole. And one of the interesting issues is whether, in terms of military service, the Congress should represent or reflect the military, or whether it should reflect and represent the country.
Now, this is something you both study. That is,
yes,
on the civil society on one side and the military culture on the other side. Is it your view, David, that in peacetime coming out of the 1990s, that there has been a drifting apart there?
I don't see it, and I think this is a point on which Peter and I disagree. It is clear that there is a culture of the military profession and the military organization, just as every profession has a culture, and most organizations that function well have cultures. The issue is whether those cultures are compatible with broader American culture, and I simply don't see a disconnect there.
Peter?
Well, when we did our study, there were two positions that were prevailing in the debate. One is the Cassandras, who said that the gap was growing dangerously wide and was a severe problem, and maybe we needed to revive the draft to address that. And the other group were the Panglosses, who said there is no problem, nothing to worry about, don't even need to study it. And the common feature of both of those groups is there wasn't much data. They were just dealing in anecdotes. So what we did was a pretty serious study, and we ended up coming down somewhere in between. We're not Cassandras. We don't think the gap is so dangerous as to pose a crisis to the United States immediately. Nor, though, do we think that the Panglosses are right, that there's absolutely no problem and nothing needs to be done. We recommend tinkering at the margins, and we certainly did not come down in favor of a draft.
Well, Peter, isn't it your view that if there's a gap between the military and society, it's a good thing that that gap exists?
Well, that's a good point. There are many gaps, and some of the gaps are indeed a good thing, so that the military tends to be in better shape than the American society, for instance. That's a good thing. And it's also true that gaps that we observe at the officer level, which is where I focused my study, don't show up nearly as widely at the enlisted level, which is where David focuses his study. And so some gaps are wide, and that's a good thing. Some gaps are not so wide, and that's a good thing. But there are one or two areas where we did see differences that are troubling, or that should be paid attention to. And the kinds of recommendations we had were much more modest. For instance, keeping ROTC at elite schools so that the officer accession into the military is spread across the socioeconomic strata of society and not limited to some, and not merely because of the quality of the people who would go into the military, but more importantly because of the quality of the friends. Let me give you an example. We have ROTC here at Duke and also at a sister institution, NC State. But the trend across the country is for the Duke-type ROTCs to diminish and the NC State-type, North Carolina State ROTCs, to expand. I don't think that's good because I want Duke...
But why is that?
Well, because
there?
I want...
Why is it good or bad, but why is it happening?
Oh, well, partly there's a hostility to the military on elite campuses. The military's policy of exclusion based on sexual identity causes a problem, particularly at the Harvards and Yales and indeed at the Dukes of the world. But I think it's a mistake to kick ROTC out of those schools because I want Duke students and Harvard students, Yale students, to have friends who are serving in the military. Because I think that does affect things at the margin, affects their understanding. So that level of connection and narrowing of the gap, I think, is useful.
And David, at that kind of gut level that Rangel appears to have touched here, to have people talking about the distinctions or what it is that distinguishes society from the military. That's got to be a good thing, no?
Absolutely, and I would never argue that the nature of civil-military relations in the United States was so unproblematic that we don't need to study it and talk about it.
Right.
And we need more funding for more research.
That's the last chapter of the book.
Yeah.
But in a democracy, the nature of the relationship between the military, the state, that is the government, and society is crucial, and it's something that needs to be monitored.
So Rangel's not playing politics with the draft here. He's finding a way to get people talking, not just about the difference between those who serve and don't, but the other aspects which are less talked about here, and that is class and race when it comes to who's in the military, who's enlisted, who's not.
Yes, and I'd like to both support Peter's notion that we need to keep the draft at elite universities, but also keep ROTC. I'm sorry,
yeah.
But also point to the importance of ROTC at a broad range of universities, and note the implications of maintaining racial diversity in, for example, state universities, where ROTC provides a large proportion of the African Americans in the officer corps. If, in fact, we cut back on diversity in universities and ROTC reduces the feed of minority officers into the military, then you run the risk of an increasingly African-American enlisted corps looking up at their management, the officer corps, and seeing increasingly white faces and feeling that there's something wrong with that picture.
And that would be troubling. I disagree with one thing you said, though, and that is suggesting that Congressman Rangel was not playing politics with his proposal. I think it's pretty clear he was. I don't think it's a serious proposal. And while it stimulates serious discussion, I think it's important to note that he doesn't really believe that this is the best way to deal with the problem. And he hasn't made any effort to discuss the downsides of moving away from the all-volunteer force. For instance, the lower military effectiveness that would cause, particularly at a time when we are using troops at a high rate, and secondly, the diminished opportunities for African Americans if we moved away from an all-volunteer force. I think if he were serious about the proposal, he'd address those issues and he would come down on the other side.
What if he gets people just talking about some form of national service, though?
But that's not what he was trying to do.
You'll note
that the members of Congress who are keen for national service didn't come back out and endorse what Rangel and Conyers are trying to do. He's just trying to score a debating point. And ironically, he can get away with it because he served in the military. And that's one of the intangibles that I worry about when the percentage of veterans in the Congress goes down, because it opens the door for the kind of score making and I don't want to say demagoguery, that's too far, but the kind of
I get to speak on this and you don't, right?
Exactly. And that's why it's good we have people like Senator McCain who have unimpeachable records and so can challenge him.
Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. Connection listeners, is it time to bring back the draft? Would conscription make the public and the politicians more inclined to peace, or at least more inclined to sober second thought when such decisions are being made in Washington? 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR.
From Boston University.
You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. My name's Dick Gordon. Our number's 1-800-423-8255. And our question this hour is whether or not it's a problem that so few members of Congress have children in the military that we ought to be looking at something like bringing back the draft. With us on the program today from Washington, David Siegel. He's director of the Center for Research on Military Organization at the University of Maryland. Peter Feaver is with us from Duke University. He's author of the forthcoming book, Choosing Your Battles, American Civil-Military Relations and the Use of Force. And we'll go first to Marblehead, Massachusetts. Donna's joining us. Hi, Donna.
Good morning, Dick.
Thanks for calling.
Thank you for asking me. I do hope that Congressman Rangel's proposal is indeed taken seriously. I don't think the issue is ROTC. I think the problem is that there's a great feeling of apathy and hopelessness among a great portion of our population because they are opposed to a war and they have no voice because we have only a volunteer military. And let me explain why I feel this way. I'm a pacifist.
Okay, go ahead.
I've been trying to have the draft reinstated for 15 years. My husband was the last of the doctor draft in 1971, and he served his time. But we had a son who was a teenager in the mid-80s, and I became very concerned about our foreign policy in Central America. And I went to El Salvador, and I happened to serve on a delegation, a fact-finding delegation, with a senator from the Midwest. And she assured me that there was no way that there was ever going to be a draft anymore because this has been a deliberate plan all along to have the National Guard and the reservists supplement a draft
but
there will never be an opposition when there is a war. And you can see
does a draft create an opposition?
Because it personalizes our foreign policy. That my neighbor's grandson might be sent over to Saudi Arabia tomorrow if there was a draft, but he doesn't even know or care about what's happening, and he feels hopeless about our foreign policy right now because he's not personally involved.
Let's hear from Peter Fever on this. Peter?
Well, I think Donna is correct in that if more people had friends and loved ones serving in the military, then their personal connection to the Iraq debate would be greater. So I agree with her intuition there. But where she's wrong is the idea that they don't have a voice absent a draft. On the contrary, the peace movement on Iraq has been pretty lively, especially compared to the its rather anemic role in the Kosovo War and in the adventures of the 90s. So it's already prominent. The Iraq decision has been debated thoroughly. People have had a voice, and the American people have reached a conclusion on that that's different from Donna's. But I don't think it's fair to say that there hasn't been an opportunity for people to express their opinion.
David, are you on board there?
Yes, I am.
Yeah. I'm just wondering whether or not you think that the draft serves the purpose that Donna suggests in at least personalizing conflict to a point where people are even more outspoken than, as Peter's saying, they are now.
It makes a contribution to bringing military affairs and the possibility of war onto the public radar screen. However, the people who are most likely to be drafted are from the very same social strata as we're getting our volunteer force from. So it's not likely that we're going to broaden the discussion socioeconomically. The fact is that American culture has historically not been very favorable to military conscription. Every time we've had a draft, we've had opposition to the draft. People forget that, for example, Martin Scorsese's new movie, The Gangs of New York, was about the New York draft riots during the Civil War. Every time we've had a draft, there has been opposition. There was massive opposition to conscription in the early months of World War II.
Right.
There was certainly a good deal of opposition during the Vietnam War. And the same thing would happen if we brought back the draft.
Is it your view, David, that we are conflating opposition to the draft with opposition to war?
I think that they got conflated during Vietnam. That was one of the reasons that we ended the draft. I think it's also the case that the American people in peacetime, if asked to institute a draft, would object to it, independent of any war.
All right, let's move along. Donna, thank you for your call. Our next caller is Larry, who's joining us from Reading, Massachusetts. Hi, Larry.
Good morning. How are you doing?
Fine. Thanks for calling.
I'm a retired senior chief petty officer, 26 years in the Navy.
Yeah.
And I served through Vietnam to the end of the Gulf War. And I sort of feel like Rip Van Winkle on this whole thing. I was very opposed to ending the draft back in the 70s, and I was wrong. I was flat out wrong because it worked out for the best for all of us in the military. I think that those of us who serve can see that today's young man and young woman is very dedicated. We don't have to babysit people anymore like we did with draftees.
What about the argument, Larry, that as long as it's an all-volunteer force, a professional army, there's this widening gap that exists between people who don't have sons and daughters in, people in society, and that people in the military culture?
But I think wasn't one of the reasons we got rid of the draft was because those of privilege who could stay in college and get out of the draft, we wanted to lessen that. I think we're having the same argument for the same reason we did away with in 73. I'm confused by that.
Peter, do you want to bring us...
Well, Larry's exactly right, and I always like to agree with senior chiefs because I was I was a junior officer in the Navy myself, and I was hopeless without and helpless without them. But here, the point is that the draft, the selective service system we had, fell apart by the late 60s and became highly selective, and children of privilege were able to avoid it, and those who were better connected were able to avoid the risk. And people recognized that that was fundamentally unfair. So in its stead was placed a volunteer system where only those who wanted to go in went in. And that's the system we have now. That's fundamentally more fair than a selective service where you only force into the military those who aren't clever enough to figure out a way out of it.
Could I say one last thing?
Go ahead, Larry.
I don't see that this could ever be a possibility in the fact that, and I think like Congressman Rangel and even maybe Senator McCain are a little out of touch. Today's soldier is not, you give him a rifle, you give him a few weeks of basic training and you send them out in the field. These people have to have computer skills. They have to have night vision, dedication, a myriad of things, multiple weapons, line systems they have to know about. And it takes a long time to train these people. You can't have 90-day wonders anymore.
Larry, thanks for your call.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
All right. To Raleigh, North Carolina, Michael's on the line. Hi, Michael.
Hey, good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Yeah, go ahead.
Listen, I apologize for joining a little late, but I agree also that you probably need to reinstate a draft because, for one thing, I'm noticing, and I'm a child of the 80s, so I disagree with what the lady was saying earlier on about some things, but I was also sort of a junior officer in the active military and in the reserves and National Guard. And one of the things that I see that we're losing is the fact that there's a lack of discipline in today's soldier because they see, for one thing, that there's a volunteer army, the volunteer military. And they're being so heavily courted by outside organizations that they can say, well, listen, if I don't like this, I can just leave, and go and make more money doing something else.
I would have thought with a all-volunteer force or a professional force, depending on how you want to look at it, that people who are there because they want to be there, and they'd have fewer problems with this sort of system of subordination.
You would hope so. And that's why I joined, because I wanted to be there. I wanted to be a soldier all my life. But then there's some people that didn't. I think we should go back to it at least and have them drafted, say, for a two-year thing like they do with the armies around the world, like the Israeli army, for example.
Well, let's go back to the point that we began with, though, Michael. Does a reinstitution of the draft, in your view, do a better job of connecting average Americans to what the army's up to?
I believe so, because if anything, it gives them a better understanding of what we do and what I did. And it gives them a better appreciation for what we do.
And do you think it'd change the way the politician? Do you think it'd change the way the politicians make their decisions as well?
Yeah, I would hope so. But politics and soldiering are two different things, like oil and water. You just don't mix sometimes.
And a good thing too.
Yeah, thank God for that. But I think it would really give the average American a really good appreciation for what we do, because a lot of folks today, they only see what they see the media allows us to see. They don't see the behind-the-scenes work that goes into, say, making a tactical operation happen. So if you're trying to move a division or move a brigade or move a corps, for example, and then you're an individual within that particular unit and understand your individual role in that mm-hmm. bigger picture, the average American person who hasn't been a part of the draft, for example, or hadn't been a part of the volunteer military, has no understanding of that.
Peter, let's hear from you on this. Peter Fever.
Well, there are some good things that would come from a draft, a sense of national service, a commitment to citizenship, a better appreciation of military operations. But those benefits have to be weighed against the tremendous costs. And the biggest cost would be the short-term loss of military effectiveness. The second big and maybe even bigger still would be the tremendous social dislocation that the debate over the draft would have.
The loss of military effectiveness, is that what Larry was talking about? The fact
precisely.
That, yeah, okay, go
precisely.
Ahead.
Precisely. We're not a drafty-based military. We don't have we don't conduct operations the way that we did in World War II.
Right.
And it's a good thing we don't, because we're much more effective now than we were then. And you just couldn't get that level of effectiveness from draftees. And frankly, given the threats the U.S. faces, I don't think that's a price worth paying at this stage.
I think, David, back to the great big gap that existed in the 1960s, the last time this conscription debate was held with real passion, where you had that part of American society that had grown up with and firmly believed in the sense of service to the nation and shared sacrifice, and that all those young people who went, yeah, but shared sacrifice for something that we have to believe in. Can the draft, as Michael is saying, do anything to bridge two parts of society, military, culture, military, civil, whatever, on such a divisive issue? Do you know what I mean?
I know what you mean. I don't think you need the draft to do that. One of the false assumptions that a lot of analysts of the volunteer force have been making is that when you go from conscription to a volunteer force, you lose a sense of soldiers serving for patriotic reasons. In point of fact, a lot of the people who were drafted were serving because they were coerced, not because they were patriotic. And by the same token, a lot of the people who are volunteering today are volunteering for patriotic reasons. We have not lost that. What we've got is a generation in which people who want to serve do serve. And when they perceive a sense of threat to national security, they step forward. Now, interestingly, there was an expectation after September 11th, 01, that that would happen with the military, and it didn't. There wasn't an increase in military recruiting, but there was an increase in recruiting for the CIA and the FBI. And given that the attacks on September 11th were defined initially as criminal, and that we were using the CIA and the FBI to fight those attacks on America, it's highly telling that Americans were lining up to join those agencies of government that they felt were defending our national security.
Michael, what do you think?
I don't know. I agree with what he's saying in some regard, too. But don't you think also, you know, volunteer army, some people were coerced to volunteer, especially if you're looking at some folks, say, they are facing either, okay, listen, you're either going to spend this time in the military or you're going to spend some time in jail. Okay?
You don't have...
I mean, it's not a draft, but it's still, it's a, I don't know, quasi-volunteerism, if you call it that. What about those people?
We don't have an awful lot of people who are given a choice between going to jail or going into the army. We did during the draft years. What we do have is some level of what is basically economic conscription. That is, people who recognize they're going to get a better deal as employees in the military than they would in the civilian labor force, and they join for economic reasons. And that's an opportunity for them. And I think that that's one of the good things of the volunteer force, that it does make opportunity available largely on not quite a race-blind basis, but certainly less racial than most American employers.
Michael, thanks for your call.
And
yes, go ahead, Peter.
I was just going to add that it's also not the case, though, that those people then are disproportionately at risk in combat. This is something that Rangel and Conyers claimed, was that African Americans were disproportionately likely to be in that economic draft that David Siegel mentioned, and therefore disproportionately likely to die in combat. But in fact, the combat arms and the special forces, the units that are most likely to see combat in operations, are underrepresented by African Americans. And so the combat exposure in today's military is not disproportionately falling upon African Americans.
I thought, Peter, if you went back and looked at the casualty statistics from Vietnam, you'd find that the number of African Americans who were killed in that conflict was slightly higher than the percentage of African Americans in society.
That was during the selective service. I'm talking about today during the all-volunteer force.
I've got you. Okay.
And where people are not only able to choose whether they join the military, but they have some control over which branch of service.
So we're better off now than we were under conscription.
Well, we certainly are not. Putting the burden disproportionately on African Americans, which is something that the Rangel and Conyers claimed. That's just not true.
1-800-423-8255. 1-800-423-TALK. Let's go to South Boston now, and Kenneth's joining us. Hi, Kenneth.
Yeah, hi. It's just been a really good conversation this morning. I think talking about the efficacy of the military with all draftees, all volunteer force is kind of not the point why this congressman has been wants to reintroduce the draft. I think he's trying to do it because Americans have kind of lost touch with what war is. Americans don't even know what veterans are anymore. I am a veteran from the Gulf War, and I'm active in some of the veterans issues regarding the local VA system. And so I know how much my neighbors. They don't know what veterans are.
What's missing, Kenneth? What are you saying is not well understood?
Well, because people don't know what veterans are. They don't know what the consequences of war are, and this is why they're so quick to jump on invading Iraq. I think if people remembered the effects of war, like they might have seen them after World War II, they wouldn't be as trigger happy as they are now. The only image that I see of war is what's on Hollywood and CNN, and I don't know if there's a difference between Hollywood and CNN. And it's very sterilized, and, you know, they don't smell the battlefield smells. They don't feel the dirt built up, you know, after 2 months without a shower, the overall grunginess. They're not in touch with that. So it's just, I think if people had a better idea of that, they wouldn't be so quick to want to do things like invade Iraq. And I think this is...
But are you saying the draft is a way of resolving this, or that there's another way?
Well, no, I think he's trying to use it as a catalyst to get people talking.
But do you buy into the idea, or you're just saying, no, good, thank goodness we're at least having the conversation?
I think we need to have the conversation. And as far as I have mixed feelings about the draft, because I think military service is kind of paradoxical for me. I see if I do my job good in the military, people won't understand... Civilians will not have to understand what war is, but when they don't understand what war is, they're quick to go into it. So I'm very confused about it. I would sign up for the draft again. I would volunteer again. I mean, that's my choice. That's who I am. But yeah, I think, I don't know. It's tough because I think Americans don't have a sense of service. I think we're a very individualistic society, and some types of national service would help us appreciate each other.
Ken, I appreciate your call.
All righty.
1-800-423-8255. Is there a gap, Connection listeners, between civilian and military culture in the United States? Is it a gap that goes so far as to affect national security, the way decisions are made on the way this country chooses to participate in wars overseas? 1-800-423-8255. My name's Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR.
Funding for The Connection is provided by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be. Available on the web at www.macromedia.com.
From Boston.
You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. Our number's 1-800-423-8255. My name's Dick Gordon. This hour, a conversation about the draft legislation that's likely to be put before Congress sometime this week, perhaps a little bit later, and put there largely to get people talking about whether or not there's too much of a gap between military culture and civil society in America, whether or not there's a lack of sensitivity or a lack of understanding to the people who serve and the decisions made about military action. 1-800-423-8255. Let's go to Columbia, South Carolina. Brant's joining us. Hi, Brant.
Hi there.
Thanks for calling.
Thank you. I have not read all of Congressman Lankel's proposal, but just from what I've seen in the news, I disagree with it on this basis. I grew up the son of a soldier, and for the last 10 years I've been in the military between active duty and the National Guard, and I'm still in the National Guard. And one of the problems that I have with this proposal is that it smacks of social engineering. And to explain what I mean is this. Decisions made as to what to do with the military should be focused on increasing the combat effectiveness of the military. And when you start dealing with an issue of let's reinstate the draft and put people that would not otherwise join the military into a military unit for the purpose of increasing Americans' awareness of foreign policy, as a guy who's got to lead troops in battle, I'm not real fond of the idea of having somebody there just to increase their education.
But what if you're off in battle and you get the sense that the people back home, the politicians, are making really cavalier decisions about, yeah, we should commit there because there isn't that connection between, you know, the congressman, the congresswoman, and a son or a daughter who's serving. Do you know what I mean?
I do understand what you mean. I'm not 100% certain how to fix it, but one of your earlier callers said there's this great feeling of hopelessness or that people have lost their voice with regards to something like a war in Iraq, and I disagree with that. They had their opportunity to make their voice very clearly heard the first week of November last year. And America as a whole spoke and said, we want these people in office because we agree with their views for X, Y, and Z. Now, does that mean everybody agrees? No. But more people chose to either agree with that or say, this is not as important to me as other issues. So, I mean, you're dealing with a totally separate political argument, but there is a mechanism in American society to have that voice heard.
Brand, let me pick up on the point that you were making about social engineering in the military and ask Peter in on this, because I think, Peter, this is something that is specifically studied in your project on the gap between military and civil society, isn't it?
Well, right. What Brandt's concern is precisely one of the concerns that was circulating in the debate in the mid-90s, that people who had no understanding of the military, now this case was people in the Clinton administration, they weren't veterans, didn't have family serving, didn't know what it was like to be in the military, were then proposing policies that that folks in the military said were harmful to them. This was the debate, and people worried that that gap between the Clinton administration and the military was resulting in social engineering policies. We looked at that issue, and there's some basis for that. There's no question that people in the military had a different view about, say, gays serving openly in the military.
Or women in combat is another one, right?
Women in combat than people who have not served in the military. So that gap, what Brandt was talking about, did exist and did shape, to a certain extent, military policy in the 90s.
And I just wanted to add that while that certainly did exist in the Clinton administration, it's not unique to the Clinton administration. And a lot of people have turned a blind eye to the fact that Paul Wolfowitz, who's one of the biggest hawks in the Bush administration, never served in the military. But it's conveniently ignored by the same conservative pundits who wanted to lambast the Clinton administration for their treatment of the military. I'm not 100% certain how to fix the foreign policy awareness of Congress and the general public, but I don't think the draft is the way to do it, because I don't think you're going to do it unless they want to know more about America's foreign policy. And even in the ranks in the military today, you see a great ignorance of America's foreign policy, even by active duty soldiers who are the instruments of that policy. There's just not a concern to themselves. They're going to go where they need to go and shoot who they're told to shoot. And beyond that, they're not as concerned about it as you might think they are. And unless, you know, the American public says, you know what, we are going to be interested in foreign policy, a draft isn't going to force them to be interested. If they don't have the desire, nothing, I don't think, is going to give them that desire.
David, let me hear from you on the point from Brandt that sort of social engineering is, I guess, in a way contributing to the gap that people see existing.
It's more commonly referred to as using the military for a social experiment. And that argument has been raised not only against reinstitution of the draft, but against racial integration, against gender integration, against lifting the bar on gays in the military. And I don't find it convincing in any case. One of the things that concerns me about the current debate is this linkage of a potential war with Iraq and the draft. The fact is that we are now deploying troops to the Arabian Peninsula. I don't know if we're going to go to war, but if we are, we are going to go to war probably within the next month and a half. If we passed a draft law tomorrow, which we are not going to do, the first draftees, after all of the court battles were fought about the conscription law, would not be coming out of the training base until the war was well over. So we're not talking about how we're going to man the war in Iraq.
But in a broader sense,
yeah,
if you tell all the mothers and fathers that, yes, in fact, the next time there are Americans going abroad and their children might go as a result of the draft.
Getting them to talk about that is worthwhile. I think the major payoff of bringing forward this legislation is not the likelihood of passing a conscription law. I don't think we will. But getting people to talk about the issue.
All right. Brandt, thank you for your call. To Sperta, Wisconsin now, and Sherman's joining us. Hi, Sherman.
Hi.
Hi. Thanks for calling.
Thank you. Obviously, the Vietnam-style draft wouldn't work, and it wouldn't do so for two reasons. One, it's cruel emotionally to rip people away from their lives unexpectedly. And two, it creates an unskilled fighting force. We've been over that. But I think what would be better, and what would at least address the class, race, and involvement issues, would be a system that requires every young person to serve a short term in the military, say 2 years upon graduation from high school. These persons could be automatically enlisted into the less skilled frontline MOSs. Of course, I don't think the rich would have that either, but I wonder if it wouldn't be a more sensitive and practical alternative to the draft.
So you're talking about militaries, 2 years in the military, not 2 years of national service. This is more like the Israeli model, where everybody has to put their 2 years in?
Yeah, and I think it might have been the German model some years back.
And what about someone who says, I'll go, but I'll work behind the scenes. I don't want to be in the front line. I mean, these are the debates that are happening right now in countries where there are conscription, like Israel.
Well, that's just the point. They'll be told that they have to go when they turn 18 or something. The rich don't have a choice. The poor don't have a choice. Blacks, whites don't have a choice.
David, when we look at countries that still have conscription, are there any lessons to be learned about the way that it either does or doesn't connect society to what the military is doing?
The major lesson we learn from those countries that used to have conscription is that they are moving away from it. The trend is for nations that had conscripted in the past and had based their forces primarily on conscription have either abolished conscription or have reduced the number of people that they draft or have shortened the period of conscripted service.
Is that because conscription wasn't working or because they just don't need that number of soldiers?
In part, it's because they don't need that number of soldiers. And you know, although Germany maintains conscription, one of their big problems with reunification is that the threat has decreased tremendously, and they've got all of these additional 18-year-olds from the East. So what they do is encourage as many people as possible to do alternatives to military service rather than serving in the military. There's one assumption that Sherman made that I want to take issue with, and that is that we can take these high school graduates and put them in unskilled jobs on the front lines. If you go out with an infantry division today, an infantry battalion, you find that those are not unskilled jobs. The technology of modern warfare is such that we need highly trained, bright people in the combat arms. And one of the problems that our allies have found with conscription is that in limited periods of conscription, they simply don't have time enough to train people to function effectively as combat soldiers.
Sherman?
The military and pretty recently, and I disagree with that. I think they can teach you to use a weapon rather quickly, and in fact, I know that they do.
Okay, Sherman, thanks a lot for your call.
Thank you.
Peter, can I ask you to sort of take a step back away from Rangel and the draft decision and speak about it in broader terms? If military service is no longer mandatory, does it become then less a feature of citizenship? Is that part of what causes the gap that we're talking about?
Well, there's a very complex relationship between citizenship and military service. Historically, the military service was one way that new immigrants proved their bona fides, that it was a way of demonstrating that you were American because you went into the military. And certainly in World War II, the role of African Americans in World War II was a significant catalyst for the civil rights movement coming back. They had sort of proven their patriotic duty or their credibility, and then they came back and said, wait a second, we deserve the full rights of citizenship. So there is military service has performed that function in the past, and that's a good function. It's not clear to me that you need military service, however, to do that. I am attracted to national service programs that are broader, that open up the ability, open up opportunities for people to serve in a broader array.
You mean AmeriCorps, Peace Corps, that sort of
thing? AmeriCorps, Peace Corps, those kinds of things. The problem with them is that they're economically very costly. And so even though I'm attracted to them, when you look at them closely, you end up saying it's probably not worth the cost. But improving one's connection to citizenship is a benefit that would come from those, and it certainly historically has benefited marginalized groups.
And the other thing, of course, David, is that you need to have respect on both sides. You need the military to respect the civilian leadership and to basically, stick with the necessary culture of following the orders that makes a military work. But you also need the public respecting what it is the military does.
That is true, and I think that both of those conditions are met in the United States under current conditions. I think one of the things that Peter's study demonstrated was that the people who were surveyed in the military were less likely to feel that military personnel should speak out against policies that they disagreed with than were the civilians that they surveyed. That was one of the issues on which, in a sense, the military was more contemporary, more perhaps liberal. It is also the case that for decades, the military in the United States has been one of the most respected institutions in the country. It's up there above the Congress, above the Supreme Court, above our universities. And surprisingly, that was true through the Vietnam War years. People were opposed to the war, but recognized that the military was an agency of government. It wasn't deciding what wars to fight, and it was respected on that basis.
So, Peter, would you make any recommendation for any kind of shift in the balance of responsibilities that exists today so what Rangel's talking about, what the draft proposal is meant to get at, is actually addressed, that people are finely tuned to the health and the safety of the people who are serving overseas?
Well, I do think it's worth recognizing that whether you've served in the military or whether you have personal connections to the military does, on average, other things being equal, does affect how you view the military. And on average, people who have connection to the military are less likely to want to use the military, and certainly less likely to use it cavalierly. And so at that level of debate, I think it's helpful, and maybe it'll boost sales of my book. Who knows? But
David, let me just hear from you. Last word from you, if I can. On that whole on a way of improving the connection between military and civil society.
Like Peter, I would, in ideal terms, be much more favorable toward a system of national service in which the military was one alternative than specifically military service. National service is costly. It has the advantage, if you're willing to accept the cost, of being universal. That is, you can find something for everybody to do. Our conscription systems have always been very selective, and they would be more so today because of the size of our population. So
All right.
Very small proportion would serve.
We're out of time. David, thanks for your time.
You're quite welcome.
David Siegel, Director of the Center for Research on Military Organization at the University of Maryland. And Peter Fieber, thank you for joining us.
It was good to be here.
Peter is director of the Triangle Institute for Security Studies at Duke University, co-editor of Soldiers and Civilians, The Civil-Military Gap, and American National Security. My name's Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.
Funding for The Connection is made possible by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be. To purchase cassettes and CDs of The Connection, please visit www.theconnection.org or phone 1-800-909-9287.
This is W.